So normally at a time like this, I would say, I'm happy to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers, but I can't exactly say that. I think what I want to say is I'm happy to be alive and on my feet, and I'd like to thank the Bell Helmet Company for that. Okay, that's what I really ought to say. And while we're at it, I should thank the KITP for having this incredibly exciting program, and especially Boris and David Ben-Simon. On behalf of all the organizers, they did a huge amount of the work creating all these fantastic talks, and naturally the speakers. So Boris told me that it would be very important to say controversial things so that then there could be something to do during the discussion sessions. So this is a cow. Okay, that's not controversial, right? This is a sacred cow. And I want to talk to you about some sacred cows of the mysterious West. When I say the mysterious West, you know, those of you from Europe, that's the mysterious East, may not have yet heard some of these floating around in the air, but you will eventually as we export all of our culture. So before I get started, I think ground rules for everything today is I don't want anybody to say we're like this and they're like that. In fact, it'd be better if we didn't say we or they at all. That's sort of the opposite of what we're here to try to accomplish. What I want to say is that here are some approaches to teaching subjects that have worked in the past, might benefit some students who aren't getting them at the moment, if we do it right. And, you know, the payoff, another part of the payoff, is that if you think carefully about what you want to teach life science students, it just might bleed over into what you teach your physics students in some profitable way. So, you know, Calvin says, consensus and common ground, it's dull. I don't want to see it. I want to see our interests narrowed and exploited by like-minded zealots. And Hobbes says, well, you may be right. And then Calvin says, oh, that's so boring. So that's what we want to avoid. We want to avoid being boring, so we want to say some things that you might not agree with. So first, here's a list of things that I don't agree with. That's why they're going to be in quotation marks. Okay, you hear this explicitly or not going around the hallways. Sometimes you hear it from administrators. Any course that stays within the confines of one discipline is ipso facto boring and obsolete. Okay. And by the way, my research is better than yours because it's interdisciplinary. Yeah, you hear that a lot. To be it's a stick that people beat each other over the head with. To be interdisciplinary, a course must be team taught by members of two or more disciplines, and it must be attended by a similarly broad group of students. I don't know about your institution, but at Penn we've had a lot of bad experiences trying to team teach courses by people from different disciplines. They separate like oil and water into two independent courses, and the students get all confused. I'm going to see if I can figure out something better than that. And after all, you know, it's important because life science students need to study physical science so they can learn to model their data. And physical science students they'll need a job someday, so they need to study life science. And, you know, these are all things I'm going to go over quickly, but I'm hoping they will resurface in the discussions. And in fact, the lecture course concept itself is dead. Lecture courses are just a lot of dry theory. At the very least, they should be done in PowerPoint. And, you know, dry theory, this is what I think people are getting at when they say that. Here's, you know, I don't follow that logic, says Dilbert. My theory predicts you would have said that. That's the sort of rap that theory gets from time to time. But I want to say the role of theory, what a positive role of theory might be in a little bit. And then students don't need extensive discussion of historical examples of discovery. After all, they're not really likely to go on to break any big paradigms. They're more likely to be grunts. And as grunts, they're going to need training on how to be good grunts who work effectively in teams, know about the ins and outs of grant writing and stuff like that. It's very interesting. Physicists sort of never got the memo on that one. We spend all our time talking about, you know, Einstein and Dirac. Here's Einstein. He's struggling so hard to reconcile this apparent contradiction. He never wrote a grant in his life, right? And he wasn't a team player either. So there's something to be said for that point of view, but there's something to be said for the other point, too. So what do I think would actually be useful to call interdisciplinary education? Well, I do think that an interdisciplinary lecture course can be useful if someone who practices one discipline shows students who are themselves pursuing a discipline how his methods have been useful in solving problems of independent interest in their field. And that echoes something that David said just a few minutes ago. And there's some good reasons, I'm going to claim, why it'd be useful to make that an intermediate course, not a freshman physics course, not least of which because freshman physics is this gigantic ocean liner that can't be diverted from its course, but for other reasons as well. I want to give you a couple of ideas that seem to have worked at my institution. So what I think would be good would be to take questions that have that sort of feeling that before you get into any theory, there's some big mysterious paradox. How could anything like that possibly happen? We had a great talk about this week, about the trombone model and replication and things like that. But there are many questions where, without getting into the guts of it, you can present something that just you can't get your head around, and some big idea is needed, and that gets people's interest, I think, and their attention. In my class, it was optical rotatory power. Something that seems like it's impossible from the point of view, and then you start figuring out, well, what kind of conceptual apparatus could make it possible. I think we want to stress to our students that understanding is tested by making falsifiable quantitative predictions. Why is it so good to be quantitative? Well, if you predict the functional form of something, then it's very, very unlikely that you would have gotten it right just by accident. It's very important to take a model that you've cooked up, put a lot of hard work into it, and push it into some region of parameter space different from the observations that motivated it in the first place, whoops, that's spelled wrong, and see if it still works or crashes. Do some new experiment that you hadn't done before to see if to poke on any soft part of that model. That's something physicists do all the time. It's something we want to consciously bring out. Then physicists, I think, we think of ourselves as the guys who consciously try to throw out details and who have this ethos that says a theory should never be more elaborate than what the data can support. And even if you've got a successful theory and it predicts things right, it's still not the right theory until you've made it as simple as you possibly can and still explain the data. You can't stop with a successful prediction. You've got to keep going and find the simplest model that succeeds equally well. That's some piece of ethos that is useful in other fields. A lot of students have trouble with the idea of approximation. And appropriate approximation is something that's really sort of the repetition of the previous point. It's really essential to understanding what you've done and what you've got and not got. Yeah. It's very important to interrupt me.
Yes, let me interrupt you.
Especially since you're the clock keeper, you can make the appropriate corrections.
So you say life science students. So is this a case of you trying to say what it is that the biology students at Penn, for example, need, or are you talking about the students that are physics majors, or are you talking about both?
At the conclusion, I'm going to say they all need it, but here we're talking about interdisciplinary education, and some of these things are, by the way, things we don't, though we think it's part of our ethos and how we do our business, even in our physics classes, we don't get it across to the extent that we'd like to. So when we teach the class, the population is about equally divided between physical science, engineering, and life sciences.
In biology, so it's all obvious what approximation means.
Right. That just means, we left some stuff out. Right. In physics, it means in principle, there's a power series expansion and you took the first term or two. Yeah. Right. And when you can be that precise, it's usually worth it. I think some things that the life science students just don't have any experience of in their education to date is this experience of being handed a problem you've never seen before. Even if it's on an exam, you have to reach into your bag, find the right tool, pull it out, and solve the problem using the right tool, though you weren't told what the right tool was. That's something we really try to inculcate, and luckily physics is such a trivial subject, there aren't that many tools in the bag, and you can figure that out. And that's a very empowering experience if you can get students to do it. In fact, your instructor, right there on the blackboard, the reason your instructor is not using PowerPoint is that they are simulating that process, inventing the subject right before your eyes, sometimes even making mistakes. I think that's a very important thing to do. Long chains of logic do lead to real conclusions with the help of mathematical discipline. That's something that we want students to get across, quite apart from any kind of factual stuff we wind up teaching them. There's some non-trivial synthetic step, and I would say that's kind of a deep thing. That's the basic epistemological miracle of physics, which is that you did some math, then suddenly there's some knowledge on the blackboard that wasn't there before, some real knowledge, even though you didn't go off to the lab and do an experiment. Okay? Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. It's nice to be able to recognize the cases where that's likely to work and try to do it. Getting back to David's talk at the beginning, it's also nice not to attempt that when it's not the appropriate thing to do and when you have to do an experiment, but there are times when you get real knowledge just by putting together ingredients that were already in your head in some new way using the discipline of mathematics, and that's what we'd like to see some examples of how that's worked in the past. So that's not very specific. Let's make it a little bit more specific. I think it would be great if life sciences came away with a reflex to check all the results for numerical reasonableness. And by the way, our physics students aren't so hot at that either. When they walk in, I'd like them to have that as well. The reflex to carry units through every calculation, intuition about significant digits. And then there are a lot of concepts that are just came out of physics and are metaphors for things that we see a lot of time. And, you know, I've got my little list here, and I'm not going to repeat it for you, but this is just exemplary. There are things like this. Some of these are sort of advanced, but there are many things like this that show up all the time, or echoes of them show up all the time in life science situations. You know, you've got people studying, Jim Hudspeth studying the inner ear, and suddenly he thinks, well, he realizes that there's this limit cycle and something is being tuned to the edge of a bifurcation, and that's what's giving you the sensitivity of the inner ear. That's a sort of idea that life science students are not going to get, with all due respect, from reading the sort of things that they read in their life science courses, and it'd be nice if we could give them some fraction of that. I think historical examples are really important. There are lots of cases where the relentless pursuit of an explanation for some how on earth could that possibly happen kind of question, based on physical observations, disclosed the existence of some new molecular actor or process maybe decades before it was biochemically isolated. And I have a couple here on the board. I've tried to include as many of those as I could in my own book. That sort of logic where you make some physical measurement and say, well, it couldn't possibly happen, I think, unless there was this invisible microscopic actor doing it. And then you go out and look for that one. That makes your search focused and directed. If you find it, you win. If you don't find it, you go back to the drawing board. That's a kind of form of logic that has had a huge payoff in the past, and we'd like students to be able to do something like that. Okay, maybe this is a slide you would want to look at on the web instead of spending time on it right now. There are a lot of interesting things here, though, that go beyond what you learn also in your freshman chemistry classes as well. Feeling for numerical data, and that's the one I really want to emphasize. You need enough numerical data before you can support conclusions. How much is enough? Well, you need a certain amount of experience to figure that out. Some data that looks really messy nevertheless supports interesting conclusions. You need to make some observations and then figure out some external knob that you could turn, predict how it will affect the results, and see if you were right. And it's equally important to make some other prediction about some other knob you can turn that's not supposed to affect the results and make sure that doesn't either. These are the ways you test theories to make sure that you've identified the correct set of relevant actors and processes. Of course, we can preach a lot about how everybody should do things better than they currently do them. It's also important to use these ideas to clean up our own acts. If you look at a standard physics course and a standard physics textbook, a lot of times, especially when we're trying to be relevant to life science, we sort of stop after showing that physics works. You know, here's some thing. Oh my goodness, isn't it pleasant to see that you know, I used optical tweezers and I applied a force and I verified the Stokes law. Well, okay, that's good, but that's just what you do to warm up and see that you know what's going on. It's very, very important, especially in our pedagogy, but in our research too, to keep focused on the intrinsic interest of the results to that other discipline. Here's some existing problem that people are stuck on. Here's something that can be used to get you over the hump. If you can do that, I think you get students' attention. It's shocking but true that, you know, you look through physics textbooks. I was trying to find a textbook for classical electrodynamics. I couldn't find any textbooks with experimental data in them. It's just sort of been squeezed out as something sort of irrelevant that you'll get onto later in life when you become a grunt in your lab. And I think that's... And you look at biochemistry textbooks, you see a lot of graphs, but yes, yes.
You want a comment on Jackson? It's a book that defines you as a physicist, remember?
It actually has real data.
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. Yeah. It has a little bit, yeah, I found that. But not much.
In fact, it's relevant to biology.
Absolutely. In our, but, I mean, Jackson might be a nice example of what I'm saying maybe could be cleaned up a little bit.
You seem to be suggesting here that you only put in questions that you know the answers for.
Ah.
At least that's what this sounds like to me. Is that correct? That your textbooks only include questions for which you already know the answers.
That's a separate point. Yeah, there are not that... I don't see physics textbooks saying much about the open questions, yes. That's not quite the same thing as saying lack of experimental data. I think when I think physics pedagogy tends to say, well, look, I went through the math, I proved it to you, what more do you want? And I think in the world you want more than that. You want, student wants to know, well, yes, but how well does that theory work? Some theories don't work as well as you might have thought just by looking at the ex cathedra derivation. So of course it'd be nice if physical, some of this bled back into what we teach physical students, science students, and this didn't have to be a very long slide. Yeah, sure, it'd be nice if physics and chemistry students understood what entropy was as an information basis. I have found that teaching biological physics was a good way to get that point across to the physics students. But of course all the points in the preceding slides are things that I would like physical science students to come away from their plain old physics courses with as well. So I don't think that there is such a huge divide between interdisciplinary and non-interdisciplinary education. And then since I only had a few minutes, I'm wrapping up now. It may seem like it's really difficult, but remember, all you have to do is a little bit better job than what you were doing before, and already you're way ahead of your chemistry department. So. And of course, there are some books embodying these ideas, not the least, the one that's forthcoming from Phillips and Yannick Kantov and Julie Theriot. And that's all I wanted to say, and I hope there'll be a lot of argument.
So, Phil, how's the technology important in the life sciences?
It's been real successful with biochemistry students. It's been real successful with bioengineering students. And it has almost minimal enrollment among biology students because of the level we pitched the mathematics. I just happened to feel that that was an audience that deserved to be served and that some other course needs to be created for the biology students, and we got to get to work on it.
How do you measure success?
They keep coming year after year is the way I measure it. They make up, you know, a half of the class, though it's not a required course for any major at all. No, we didn't quantitate success beyond that. It's got a 200 number. We have found that a lot of sophomores wish they had waited a year before they took it, so it's, in effect, it's more a junior-senior course. Yeah, Robin.
A problem with an interdisciplinary class is that the background of the students is very different.
Right.
Even in big universities,
absolutely.
Same sort of class, the background can be very different. In teaching biology and physics students, how do you avoid referring only to the smallest common denominator?
We set the prerequisites high, which is one reason why not many biology students take it. We insisted on a full year of freshman physics as the prerequisite to this course so that I could write down a very elementary differential equation without a long digression.
These are biology students who have taken...
No, as I said, very few biology students take. These are biochemistry, bioengineering, and physics students. And other material science, other all different engineering disciplines are the ones who take this course.
Okay, so who had some comfort with, who had seen good general physics class?
Even so, we had to go a lot slower than you would have gone with a pure physics class, and we just had to have a lot of office hours and problem sessions, for sure. About one third physics, one third engineering, and one third biochemistry, I think is how I remember it. And by the way, this course is in its like eighth year now, so it's not going away. Yeah.
So did you have success handing it over to anyone?
Yeah, that's right.
I did. That's extremely important.
How many people have taught it?
Two people have taught it. So I handed it over to Mark Gulian, and as far as I can tell, he's doing a better job than I ever did. But yes, it's very important to make it close enough to the comfort zone of your other colleagues that they can do it. Chris?
So one of the points you made was about the bottom of one science that it's important that people come from a physical science background because physical scientists have a good intuition for data. So...
Uh-oh. I think it's a bit of a paraphrase, but okay.
Can you talk about how much you talk about data in your class or statistics? Because statistics is not really one of the canons of theoretical physics. And, has some relevance to a lot of problems that are coming up in biology as biology becomes more and more data intensive.
You bet. That is so important and so big that it needs a whole other class. We talk a little bit about what conclusions can and cannot be supported by least squares curve fitting to data, you know, which is even to get across the point that there's a limit to what conclusions can be drawn. There is some limit to what conclusions can be drawn is already an important thing to get across to a somewhat uncritical audience. It's not a big part of the class, right? It's in there, but it deserves a whole class, actually. Yeah.
How many students
Martin.
Do you have in class?
We get about 25 per year on a once a year. We've been running it with a grader, and I think it would definitely benefit from a TA who ran a problem session. That's a budgetary thing, yeah. Yes.
What's been done to define sort of the most efficient way to teach biologists the math they need to take this kind of stuff? And has it been carefully thought out? I mean, in most of my experiences, you take a lot of math that is not that relevant, and many of the graduate students we have at our place are still turned off by the fact that they've had all this sort of what they view as irrelevant mathematics. They don't want anything more to do with it.
Yes, okay. We're fortunate that our math department offers a flavor of calculus supposedly for life science majors with a lot more statistical aspects to it. How good a job they're doing, I'm not sure, but that's. We hope that the market is great enough for math departments to do something like that.
So you're saying that the problems of getting math is taught by theorems and proofs and for math majors,
you know, yeah. For engineers
what they,
or whatever.
What they feel
yeah, yeah. Or whatever, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, you can take 3 years of college mathematics and still not have the right mathematics for some of the things you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. I'm just hoping that they know what a derivative is and what the very simplest differential equation solutions are.
But I think that needs to be solved earlier. I mean, we just started talking with the MTD department and applied math to actually put math and physics in the undergraduate biology courses. Not a big block, but just try to be quantitative on certain topics.
Oh yeah, modifying another department's courses.
Not going to be the perfect solution, but it's
yeah. You can tell us quite a lot, I think.
I think even our graduate students would be very useful if they had sort of a guide to what math they should really remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So I personally scrupulously avoided the problem that I think of as being remedial mathematics education for biologists. No offense. Happiness of the way they teach math in the math department. And somehow for the last 100 years we've managed to deal with it. But that's because, as you were saying, it's because there's a lot of math even in the physics courses.
Yes.
So and that's really the solution. I mean, I wish it were the case that there were people in the math department who were more interested in integrating the teaching of mathematics with the teaching of science. Forget physics, biology. But I think the reason that it works in physics and it doesn't work in biology is not because when we send the physics students to the math department, they learn these things that are especially relevant to physics. It's because when we teach them physics, we're constantly exercising their mathematical skills.
I agree.
And so whatever they learned works out. And so a lot of the problem is that, you know, you go through biology courses and nobody ever writes down an equation. So how... It doesn't matter what you learn in math.
Yes.
Ultimately, it's the final product that you're after, and so how you get there could have many pathways.
Certainly.
One pathway. This is a bizarre idea, but years ago when McKinsey wanted to get people who understood, who could work in quantitative finance.
Yeah.
They tried to hire people with MBAs, and they found that the bottom half of even the Harvard class was not up to their
quality of the standards. And so they had this brilliant idea, and that is to hire a bunch of mathematicians and physicists and better chemists and electrical engineers, and then give them a crash course in finance in 3 months. And they had a pretty good success.
Yeah.
What's the prospect of actually starting out with teaching people physics? Because after all, it seems that the pons asinorum is math and math, etc. Teaching them physics, and then at some late point in their career, give them a crash course or a bunch of crash courses in
or a PhD. In biology.
That's what happened to most of the people.
Yeah.
Through
them.
I'm not talking about the PhD. I'm talking about a new undergraduate approach.
I see.
To transform them into thinking, functioning biologists who have a quantitative look on it.
I think those people are called biophysics majors at my university. They spend a couple of years taking physics and chemistry, and then they take the biology courses at that point, and that's very effective for them. Yeah.
But also the question is, how much discipline is enough for the discipline? You can say, 2 years of physics, or you can say an undergraduate physics degree, or you can say PhD in physics, or you can say postdocs, tenure, and there's probably room for more. But we're sort of talking about kind of adult education, and KP does that kind of thing. Now we can sort of view our educational mission as adult education. I think. But on the other hand, maybe it is possible to implement it on the level of a PhD, a second PhD. I guess there is MD for PhD, so can there be the biology PhD for physics?
Well, the question was about undergraduate, and ideally I would like to see our biology department offering a course for scientifically sophisticated upperclassmen that covers their freshman material, but not in the pre-med style. Yes, I think I would send every physics major to take that 2 semesters of that, if it existed, and I like that very much.
The flexibility in the physics courses is much larger than in the life sciences. If you are
right.
in a large university,
right.
then a life science student has an incredible load of courses already to
yeah.
take.
Yeah.
So if we come to a life science department and said, well, we would like your students actually to take a couple more math courses and physics courses so they're really well prepared, if they're polite, they give you 5 minutes, and if they're not polite, they...
Well, that's why the Bio 2010 report is extremely valuable. You can put that on the table and pound on it until they listen to you.
So in practice, it is the
yeah.
one course which we are teaching to life science students, which is all we have to play with.
Right. Well, that brings us to your talk, I think, which we'd like to hear a lot about what you how you manage that course. Yes.
Phil. I think
yeah.
we should move on.
Okay.
The game plan is to probably sort of absorb into the discussion period, so
yeah.
we can be pretty casual.
Great.